Our second case for this morning is the matter of MDD, delinquent child, and appearing for the child and appellant is David Wheeler, and appearing for the state is Mr. Frank Geegan. Mr. Wheeler, you may proceed.
Justice Konenkamp, may it please the court, counsel.
I think the last time we saw you was the Sam Mastin final.
That is correct. This is my first time arguing for the court for real. I am here today to ask this court to reverse the order of restitution entered by the circuit court below. There are two independent ways in which the circuit court erred. First, it incorrectly determined that a child in a juvenile delinquency proceeding can be ordered to pay restitution to a third-party payer, in this case, Medicaid. Second, it failed to make any findings regarding the hardship or injustice that an order of restitution could impose upon the child. I'll first address the issue of restitution to third parties. The first half of the juvenile restitution statute, SDCL 268B6 sub 4, states that, quote, the court may require the child to pay for any damage done to property or for medical expenses under conditions set by the court. The question then becomes whether the term medical expenses also includes subrogation claims by third parties. In State v. Fryer, the court looked at the ordinary and popular meaning of the term victim and came to the conclusion that insurance companies did not qualify. It drew a distinction between the direct damages that the actual injured party receives and the indirect damages that insurance companies incur by paying insurance claims.
But Mr. Wheeler, the juvenile statute doesn't use the term victim and doesn't define the term victim like it did in the criminal statute that was interpreted in the Fryer case.
That's correct, Your Honor. There are definitions of victim within the juvenile code. And they both use the same language. At the end of Chapter 23A-28, there's Section 14, which specifically deals with juvenile matters. It defines victim not using the enlarged definition of victim found at the beginning of that chapter that applies to adults.
23A is the adult code.
Yes, Your Honor. At the end of 23A-28 is Section 14, which is there and deals only with juvenile delinquency acts. And within that section, there was a specific definition for victim. And it did not use the definition at the beginning of that chapter that would apply to adult cases. It used a definition. It actually referenced two other statutes that defined victim. One of them defined victim as a natural person against whom a crime was committed, and the other one defined it as the direct subject of an alleged crime. Both of those terms, natural person and direct subject, simply cannot be construed to apply to the insurance companies or, in this case, Medicaid.
Let me ask you, as far as the terminology in the adult, does it use the same language here, damage done to property or for medical expenses? Does it use medical expenses in that particular term in the adult statutes at all?
No, Your Honor.
So does that make a difference then? As far as medical expenses,
yes.
Does that then by itself sort of define who the victims might be in a juvenile case?
Yes. I mean, I believe when looking at that term in conjunction with the definition of victim, we find that the legislature has intended to maintain a narrow definition of victim, and that should carry over to how we interpret medical expenses, to only those expenses directly incurred by the injured party, not subrogated claims from third parties.
However, with the juvenile statute here, everything should be construed with the least, or determined, the disposition with the least restrictive alternative, which also does not appear in any kind of an adult disposition. And the least restrictive alternative, then, does that affect the way we should look at restitution for medical expenses or damage done to property?
Yes, Your Honor. The least restrictive alternative language is designed to, I think, facilitate the rehabilitative aspect of juvenile court. And when we're teaching the lesson to juveniles that you do have to pay for your actions, it doesn't need to be so oppressive that everybody has to be repaid, that the person the juvenile knows, the person who, in this case, the juvenile committed the assault upon, is made whole. In this case, it was made whole by a third party. The juvenile doesn't need to go the extra step of paying back Medicaid in order to learn the lesson that you can't commit that act.
Are you saying that the trial court is restricted from making that decision in disposition as to what is best for rehabilitation for the child and showing them that they have to pay for their acts?
I think that the trial court is restricted by the term medical expenses. And if the term medical expenses in a juvenile setting is limited to only those expenses incurred directly by the victim, then it would be restricted and would not be able to, in any case, give an insurance company an award in a juvenile case.
You're saying the statute ties the hands of the trial court.
I do, Your Honor. The in this case, in the case of State v. Fryer, is the case from 1995. I'm sorry, I think that's a 1993 case that the court went to examine the issue of victim for adult cases. And I think that is instructive in how the court viewed the issue of damages to a victim versus damages to an insurance company. At the end of that opinion, the court was presented with the option by the state of remanding the decision and having the full amount of the award granted to the actual injured party. This court rejected that and said, well, even on a remand, the injured party only has, in that case, $1,000 pecuniary damages, and that even on remand, you still wouldn't be able to order the insurance company to pay that. I believe this court was recognizing that distinction between medical expenses that are incurred by a victim and those subrogation claims. I believe that
technically, could you use the term medical expenses when you talk about what in this case it's actually a government program that paid for it? The government program, Medicaid, does Medicaid even refer to medical expenses, or would those be medical payments as opposed to medical expenses? Because it would have been the victim that received the payment.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm not.
Maybe I'm not making myself clear, but
yeah.
I guess it. You know, when you look at the subrogation, it's they're subrogating for a payment, as opposed to what the expenses might have been.
Yes, Your Honor. I guess I'm not completely familiar with the exact language of the Medicaid statutes, mm-hmm. but I believe that distinction, if there would be valid.
And is there a distinction here because it is a government program?
I think that is, it does actually make a distinction because the government basically has already taken on the responsibility of paying for the victim's medical needs. And the fact that a juvenile, in this case, the delinquent child, could be made to pay that doesn't need to be part of the equation, because regardless, the government is going to be taking care of the bill. The distinction between medical expenses and subrogation claims, I believe, was also recognized by the legislature when in Chapter 23A, 28, when it enlarged the definition of victim to include insurance companies and third-party payers. It still, within that definition, gave priority of claim to the injured party, the direct victim, as opposed to any person who has a claim to indemnity or subrogation. And that language, to a claim to indemnity or subrogation, is there in the statute, which gives further evidence of this distinction. At the same time that the, I think it's interesting to note that in the same year that the court, that the legislature enlarged the definition of victim to include third-party payers for adult courts, it enacted the statute that became Section 14 that narrowed it for juvenile court. So in the same session, we have an enlargement for adult court and a narrowing for juvenile court, which I think is a pretty clear indication that the legislature is trying to maintain a narrow definition of victim for juvenile cases. The second half of the statute, though, also provides another set of grounds for reversing the court below. The second half requires or states that a court may enter the order of restitution if payment can be enforced without serious hardship or injustice to the child. Under the statute, restitution is actually discretionary, and that discretion can be exercised if restitution can be enforced without serious hardship.
Did you preserve your record on this before the trial court in bringing forth evidence that to show that this would be a hardship?
It was a part of my my argument to the court. Although my argument to the trial court focused mainly on the issue of third-party payers, I did reference the fact that the child would not have the same ability to pay. I also included it in my alternate findings of fact that were submitted and rejected by the trial court.
So the findings of fact that you submitted, the proposed ones, were submitted before the court actually made a decision on the restitution. Is that right?
It was, the judge ruled from the bench.
Okay.
In that case.
But then the judge signed the findings proposed by the state as opposed to yours.
Yes, Your Honor.
But Mr. Wheeler, if the trial's over, and I should say when the trial's over, there's no more opportunity to put on evidence about hardship. And if neither side presented evidence of hardship during the course of the trial, what good is it going to do to propose a finding, you know, a week or two later to the trial judge that this would cause a hardship if nobody put on evidence about hardship at the trial? If you didn't claim it and give the state an opportunity to respond, how could the trial court possibly enter a finding one way or the other on that?
Typically in juvenile matters, practitioners don't. I wouldn't have put up my client on the stand to actually give evidence. It's always part of the argument that that my client doesn't have the ability to pay back an amount. The judge was also made aware of my client's particular inabilities to pay during the course of the proceedings and during the different assessments that were done of the juvenile.
You were appointed to represent this
judge? I was, Your Honor.
So you say the judge was made aware. You mean that the judge was informed whether the child had a job or not, or whether the child had savings and things of that nature? Is that what you're saying?
I don't believe savings were ever addressed, Your Honor. I believe during the initial, if I remember correctly, the original disposition that occurred, I believe in July, when the child was originally put on probation, all those issues were addressed, and the court was made aware of the child's different abilities.
So the court was, so somewhere in the record before the court, there was information about what jobs the child had or didn't have, so forth.
I don't want to specifically say that because I know there were two just separate dispositional hearings, and I don't, in my mind, want to confuse the two and mislead the court.
Well, just tell us today, then, what evidence of, other than argument, what evidence of hardship was there? Is there in this record?
there was the child was on an IEP through school and had some disabilities. The child, the only job the child had was doing odd jobs for neighbors, helping some neighbors with, I believe she may have done some minor amount of babysitting, but it was very, very minimal. She was mainly going to school, and that was about it. She was. We were trying to push her in that direction of focusing on school because she was on this IEP and not making her get a full-time job.
All right.
And she was placed in the Department of Corrections.
That was actually after the order of restitution.
Okay.
There was.
But then that wasn't revisited when she went to the DOC.
No, Your Honor, we did not. We did not readdress the issue of restitution during that.
When the court rejected your proposed finding that there was a hardship, did the court make some finding contrary to that, that this was not a hardship, or that the child did have the wherewithal to pay this restitution in full?
No, Your Honor. The court's findings of fact were simply what the stipulation was at the time of the restitution hearing. And there was no reference to hardship.
All right. If there was no reference of hardship, are you saying the court abused its discretion in not making a decision on hardship, or are you saying that is a required finding based on the statute by the trial court, and the fact that it didn't address it is a required finding by the statute? Which
the latter, Your Honor, that findings of fact are required at any final dispositional decree, and that the statute doesn't allow for this portion of the statute to be ignored, and that the court needs to consider it and enter findings.
So in every case, the court has to make a finding on hardship.
Based on the language of the statute, I believe that is true. The statute says, to parse it out, it says it may order if restitution can be enforced without hardship or injustice. The use of the word if creates a condition precedent that the second half must be dealt with before the order of restitution can actually be entered.
So you're saying this is something the court just needs to consider or has to consider. It doesn't necessarily, by the wording of this subsection 4, put the onus on the child to prove that they're not seriously that there's not serious hardship or injustice. But that's really a provision that the court has to decide first based on the evidence in front of it, as well as determining the least restrictive alternative.
That's correct, Your Honor. If this court were to not require findings on this issue, it would tacitly create a presumption that there is no hardship or injustice, and that the child has to rebut that issue in every case. The better practice is to implement both halves of the statute equally. Because there is no allocation of burden, burden should be on the state in a criminal proceeding unless it's allocated somewhere else, thereby properly placing the burden either upon the state or upon the court to consider that. By doing that, it ensures that a court is dealing with the issue of both the needs of the victim and the needs of the defendant at the same time. In a juvenile delinquency proceeding, the courts operate under separate rules and under separate procedures. It is entirely reasonable that this applies to the restitution statutes, that both on the issue of third-party payers and on the issue of whether hardship is a requisite finding, whether it is necessary in an adult court to address those is simply irrelevant to the case in juvenile court. Both issues are distinguishable by both statute and case law, and I believe that the appropriate finding for this court is to reverse the order of restitution. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wheeler. Mr. Gigan, you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. In light of MDD's recent motion to dismiss that portion of her appeal regarding her commitment to the Department of Corrections, the only issue left to address is whether the trial court erred in ordering MDD to make restitution to Medicaid. The record reflects that restitution was awarded as a result of an incident taking place on or about May 11, 2008, where MDD was said to have recklessly caused bodily injury to the victim. As alleged in the petition seeking to have MDD declared a delinquent child, she was driving and operating her vehicle in a manner likely to endanger others. She later admitted to civil assault and was therefore determined adjudicated to be a delinquent. In its order of restitution, the trial court found that MDD did cause injury to the victim in the amount of some $2,790. MDD, along with her attorney, stipulated that was the amount of medical expenses incurred by the victim as a result of the incident accident in question. MDD, therefore, was ordered to reimburse Medicaid, the third-party payor, in that amount. Now, there was no question that if tried as an adult, MDD clearly would have been responsible for making restitution to Medicaid. MDD concedes as much. As indicated in her brief, the legislature, in 1995, amended statute 23A-28-2, subparagraph 5, to specifically include insurance companies and other third-party payors within the definition of victim. That amendment was in an apparent response to the decision in State v. Fryer, issued 2 years earlier in 1993, where this court found that the ordinary and popular meaning of the term victim did not include an insurance company. According to the court, a health insurance company that paid for injuries to the victim was not itself a victim entitled to receive restitution benefits. As amended, however, in 1995, statute now defines victims to specifically include any person who has by contract or by statute undertaken to indemnify another or to pay or provide a specified or determinable amount or benefit upon determinable contingencies. The question, therefore, on appeal is whether that definition should also apply, also extend to juvenile cases. Relying on the language in SDCL 23A-28-2, subparagraph 2, which defines criminal activities, MDD argues that the expanded definition of victim should be limited to what she refers to as adult crimes. According to MDD, juveniles are subject to a much different set of procedures than are adults, and their actions are treated much differently than those committed by an adult. MDD, therefore, argues that juveniles should not be required to make restitution, including the payment of subrogation claims to insurance companies. The trial court, during the restitution hearing, summed up MDD's argument the best when it stated, and I quote, "So, in effect, your argument is that a juvenile should be allowed to commit crimes regardless of the amount of damages caused thereby, and yet not be held responsible for that damage." The state, however, would submit that public policy also requires that the juvenile likewise make restitution to the victim of her delinquent acts. As Mr. Wheeler discussed before, this provision in the Juvenile Code 26-8B-6.4, which specifically authorizes the trial court, as part of its dispositional decree, to require the child to pay for any and all damage to property, as well as medical medical expenses, under conditions set by the court.
Are there statutes still in effect in the juvenile code that limit the amount that you order in restitution? There used to be a cap on it. Is there still, or is that?
I'm not aware of any, Your Honor, and I certainly don't believe that issue was raised or addressed in the appellant's brief.
I understand that. I was just curious. But the obviously, you talk about public policy, though. The whole public policy and how to deal with juveniles has been set by the legislature when it talks about least restrictive alternatives, best interests of the child, undue or not with, or without serious hardship or injustice to the child. Those are the policies that have already, the public policy as far as how do we handle children, has been established by the legislature. I don't think that's least anything this court can do.
Typically, the least restrictive alternative analysis is basically applied in those instances
whereas the last resort, they remove the minor child from the family home and place them, say, in a facility within DOC's control and custody. I don't know if that terminology or language is necessarily used to address the restitution issue.
But you would agree, however, best interest of the child, though, is still part of it, correct?
Right, best interest of the child.
With the restitution, you're looking at what's in the best interest of the child.
Exactly.
Rehabilitation or restorative justice.
Responsibility
or
and accountability for the damages, expenses that occur as a result of delinquent acts. Exactly.
Are you saying that the court then is required to order all restitution in every case?
No, I think, like I said, the juvenile code specifically says that the court can order medical expenses under such conditions as set by the court. Now, I think we're getting into the second issue, I believe, with regard to whether or not the trial court in this case failed to consider the alleged hardship imposed by requiring MD to make restitution.
Now, we wouldn't even be here, and we all would agree that had the judge ordered, or possibly, the judge ordered the restitution for the medical expenses had the victim incurred medical expenses. The problem here is that the victim didn't incur any because they were paid by a third party.
But there's no indication in statute, the 26-8B-6, which would indicate that the legislature intended that the term medical expenses be limited to actual out-of-pocket expenses incurred directly by the victim.
Nor does it not specifically say, however, that it also includes third party.
Right, but
as it specifically does in the adult statute.
Exactly. As indicated by MDD in her brief, legislative intent must be determined from the statute as a whole, as well as other enactments relating to the same subject matter. This court on repeated occasions has said that statutes must be construed in pari materia when they relate to the same person or thing with the same object or purpose.
So what are we construing in pari materia?
The two restitution statutes, construing the term medical expenses is used in the juvenile code along with the definition.
So you're saying they do need to be considered in conjunction with the adult definitions?
Exactly. Most courts that have rejected arguments similar to that being now advanced or proposed by MDD.
There's nothing in the legislative language, though, that would indicate that they intended that the adult statutes apply to juveniles, do they?
There's a specific reference, and Mr. Wheeler made reference to it, in 23A-28-14, which specifically authorizes the release of certain information to any victims of any act of juvenile delinquency.
So they can pursue it as a civil action if they need to.
Right, but there's no indication.
Isn't that what the intention there is? So if the court doesn't order restitution, they can release the name to the victim, and the victim can sue the parents or the child or whatever if they can to recover.
True, but the definition of the victim upon that specific provision relates to release of information. There was no indication in 23A-28 in referring to the juvenile delinquency proceedings that the legislature intended to prohibit or prevent restitution from being awarded. In fact, MDD in a brief concedes, and I quote, the whole of SDCL Chapter 23A-28 cannot be written off as having no application to juvenile proceedings. The state would submit that it is well established that restitution statutes should be broadly construed and interpreted so as to allow victims to recover restitution for the expenses they incur as a result of criminal conduct committed at the hands of others. Those statutes should be applied and restitution should be awarded regardless of whether that criminal conduct was committed by an adult or, as in this particular case, a juvenile delinquent.
Well, again, I don't understand what you're arguing. Are you saying that the court is limited, that it has to order restitution for the full amount?
No, it's within the court's discretion. In this particular case, the reason the court ordered restitution in full amount to $2,790 because there was absolutely no indication whatsoever, no evidence presented at all by MDD regarding the fact that she would have been unable to make restitution.
Well, whose burden is that to look at that and make that determination? Is that her burden to prove that?
The state believes it is. As indicated in the case cited to in the state's brief, courts have rejected the notion that the trial court is under an obligation to raise that matter sua sponte. Courts have found that the trial courts, lower courts, are under no independent obligation to raise that matter on behalf of the juvenile. Typically, the obligation to establish inability to pay rests with the juvenile, especially in a case such as this where At no time whatsoever during the restitution hearing did MDD raise or present any claim regarding her inability to make restitution. If you look at the transcript of the restitution hearing, you'll find that there was simply no indication at all, no indication whatsoever by MDD that she was financially unable to make restitution payments.
Well, is there any evidence that she was financially able to? If she was a student on an individual educational plan, had only done odd jobs, that's only evidence in the record of her ability to pay.
But again, you're putting the onus on a trial court. I think absent some indication, some claim raised by MDD to juvenile to alert or to notify the court that there's an issue regarding ability to pay.
Well, I think that I'm just looking at an excerpt here, and I see that counsel said to the court that the juvenile isn't going to have the same earning ability as an adult, and it's going to become more of a burden upon the family and to make someone whole. So there was at least some comment.
Right, that was the sole reference of her earning ability as a juvenile compared to that of her family, and that the burden of making the restitution payments may in all likelihood eventually end upon being on a parent.
Does the if statement in the statute, where it says if payment can be enforced without serious hardship, is that a condition precedent, as counsel has argued?
No, I believe the if condition in the statute is, again, contingent upon there being some showing by the appellant, or in this particular case, the juvenile delinquent, saying, I mean, some indication in the record as to what earning capacity is versus, you know, what other obligations there are.
Wouldn't the record here have speak for itself on that? I mean, the court would have known the child had did odd jobs, that the child was there wasn't much there that would indicate that the child had the wherewithal to come up with this kind of...
Well, I would assume, yes, in the application process for court-appointed counsel and whatnot, that information may have been included. But again, that being said, the state believes it's still incumbent upon the juvenile or her counsel during the restitution hearing itself to at least raise that matter, to alert the trial court to say, hey, look, you know, there's an issue as far as financial inability to pay.
Mr. Wheeler's position was that the court would, due to the language of the statute, that the court would have been required to make findings on that issue. Do you agree that in every case that there is a restitution, that the court is required to make a finding on ability to pay?
I would think those findings are still incumbent upon some showing, some presentation, or an attempt to raise that issue by the juvenile before that responsibility is then forced upon the trial court to address that in its findings.
Even if there's, you know, with an adult proceeding and restitution becomes an issue and the defendant raises saying that I don't believe there's that much restitution due, doesn't the burden then shift back to the state at that point to present evidence to show that this victim is really due X amount that they're asking for?
Right.
I don't know that burden comes away from the state.
If there is a dispute as to the amount of restitution, oh, certainly the state has to put on
right.
evidence, records.
But wouldn't that be true if it was raised that this is a serious hardship or injustice to the child, that then really it's up to the state then at that point to show that there isn't?
Right. Once the issue is raised, yes, I believe the burden then transfers to the state, and then it's incumbent upon the trial court to enter findings to that effect. But here the state's position is absent that sole reference to due to her age, the burden would fall upon the parents. The state doesn't feel that suffices to alert to put the court on notice that it has to make detailed findings as far as any hardship or injustice that would result from requiring restitution.
What about the fact that there's then a proposed finding made by counsel after the court makes an oral decision, but before the court makes a written decision? Isn't that the purpose of proposed findings, to alert the court that maybe there needs to be some supplementary hearing?
I apologize to the court. I don't know what's in the proposed findings submitted on behalf of the juvenile. That wasn't a matter that was raised in the appellant's brief, nor were those findings included in the appendix. So the state's simply not in a position to respond to what was or was not in those proposed findings. So, unless there are any further questions from the court, the state would close by simply asking that the award of restitution be affirmed in all respects.
Thank you, Mr. Gagan. Mr. Wheeler, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you. I'd like to address some of the issues raised by the state. First, the issue that public policy requires restitution be able to be ordered to be paid to insurance companies. I believe this court rejected that argument in State v. Fryer when dealing with the same type of issue in adult matters, that public policy on whether or not insurance companies can be paid is not the primary factor. It's what the language of the statute says, that and that if the making victims whole argument didn't apply to adults at that time, it also logically wouldn't apply in this case. We are dealing with the language of medical expenses and whether or not that includes subrogation claims. The public policy that should be considered is those expressed by the legislature in the juvenile code regarding least restrictive means and an intent to rehabilitate. The state also raised the fact that this court should construe the juvenile code together with the adult code. And when making this decision, I believe that is an error in this case because of the way the legislature has distinguished the adult code from the victim, from the juvenile code, especially in regards to this definition of victim, that it narrowed that definition in the same legislative session to include only the direct victim. And therefore, the statutes that should be construed together are the restitution statute found in the juvenile code and that definition of victim found within in the last section of Chapter 23A, 28. I think it's also interesting to note that the very next year, in 1996, the legislature adopted that same narrow definition of victim in a separate statute directly in the juvenile code that dealt with what parties can be present within the courtroom, which I believe shows that it was maintaining that narrow definition. That was also the same year that the words or medical expenses were actually added to the statute. They were not there until 1996, which I think when we construe that with the legislative history to that date, the legislature would have been aware of this issue of whether insurance companies can be given an order of restitution and also the narrow definition of victim. I think we take all that together.
Well, why aren't medical expenses regardless of who pays them?
Because I believe the distinction is where the direct expenses come from. That the intent of the legislature was to include, using the word medical expenses, were those expenses paid by the victim, and not to include those subrogation claims. If they wanted to include insurance companies in subrogation claims, they could have easily done that by having gone through this issue just the year before, easily said medical issues and including those incurred or medical expenses including those incurred by the insurance companies by paying their claims.
But how do you get around the fact in the adult setting that the legislature did limit the expenses to those incurred by victims? And in the juvenile context, they did not use that limiting language regarding victims. Doesn't that suggest the legislature did not intend to use the victim distinction language by not including it in juveniles but including it in adults?
I think the narrowing of when the legislature is considering what medical expenses are going to be paid, I think they would be considering the same type of victims that they are allowing into the process. The very fact that the Section 14 is the vehicle by which victims can get the information needed to pursue restitution, and the legislature withheld that information from insurance companies. And so when construing that with medical expenses, Although it would have been better for our position if they had said that, use that language, I think the intent of the legislature is that that term medical expenses is those are those borne by the injured victim. I'd also like to address the issue on whether courts have an obligation to sua sponte raise the issue of burden. The vast majority of the authorities cited by the state in its brief comes from states in which that burden is specifically allocated by statute, and which I therefore believe does not directly apply in this case. Our language is much different than those other statutes. The use of the word if in contract law, in the restatement of contracts, in Black's Law Dictionary, defines it as creating a condition precedent. And therefore, that second half of that statute must be considered, just as the court has to make a finding on what the amount of damages are. It has to make a finding on whether there is a serious hardship.
Now, the state argues, however, even if it is a condition precedent, that it has to be raised by your client and brought before the court. Was there enough information that was could be considered raised at during any of these proceedings?
Except for my references to the child's inability to pay, I never used the word hardship. So I'd have to exceed on that point. But that still places, in effect, that would still place the burden on the child to raise the issue and bring the proof, whereas the language of the statute does not allocate that burden. And therefore, until the legislature allocates that burden, we should keep it on the state until something has changed, because that's where I believe it appropriately begins, especially with this language of the statute. Basically in every case, the court, when considering the best interest of the child, needs to be considering that at the same time and shouldn't make it dependent upon the child, especially in cases where, in juvenile court, where children are without counsel. The court has to take that extra role of considering both the victim and the needs of the child. And without changing that burden, without placing that burden directly on the defendant, I believe it is best placed on the state or on the court to keep that issue in mind and make those requisite findings.
Well, there's no question the court has to keep it in mind, but tell me where you said that this child would incur a hardship. I see in your argument where you're talking in general about the purposes of the act. You're making an argument about the adult juvenile victim statutes, and you're saying in general that children generally don't have the ability to pay. But are you telling us that there's someplace in the record where you said, Judge, this kid doesn't have the ability to pay?
I did not state it that explicitly, no, Your Honor.
What's the closest you came?
The closest I came was making the court aware of the issues of her ability to pay. The language that was quoted by the state in the restitution hearing itself. As I said, I did not use the word hardship. I did not specifically raise this half of the statute at the restitution hearing. Although the court was, I believe, cognizant of the child's circumstances.
Was there a report that the court had in front of him from court services?
No, Your Honor. The only reports done were, there was two, I'm sorry, I said, no, at the time of the restitution statute, actually, there weren't, at the restitution hearing, there were no such reports.
Well, counsel for the state said that they were unable to respond to the question about your proposed findings because that issue wasn't raised in your brief, and I wanted to know if you had any response to that.
I believe this court in the past has allowed the fact that findings were proposed and rejected without having the issue been brought up. I cannot cite the name of the case, but it was regarding whether a cop and a police when stopping someone had a belief that they were subject to harm or had a reasonable belief about that. And this court held that, although it was not raised in the suppression hearing, the fact that the state included it as a in its findings of fact, conclusions of law, was enough to preserve that issue.
So did the court, in this case, make a finding that it was not a hardship?
No, Your Honor.
So it's just silent. The record is silent on whether or not it's an injustice or a hardship.
That's correct. The only findings were within the order of restitution. There's, I believe, 3 or 4 findings, and then the order itself. And that was the only...
And never any reference, either on the record or written by the court, to indicate that this was would have been a hardship or wouldn't have been a hardship.
Not that I can recall, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Wheeler.
Thank you.
We'll be in recess until 11 a.m.